From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Black Lives and Blue Lives. We hear from Tom Gibbons, a former Philadelphia police officer who was shot three times and nearly killed during a traffic stop.
Suddenly, my partner yelled over the roof of the car, "Look out, Tom, he's got a..." And I never heard the word. All I heard was a gunshot.
Also, Eric Adams talks about the dual perspective of being African-American and a former cop. He joined the NYPD with the intention of helping reform it because at 15, he was beaten by police.
Every time I saw a police vehicle, every time I heard a siren, I relived that. That is why I went in with such an aggressive mindset of reform.
And Matt Johnson talks about the police and race from his perspective as an African-American, father, and novelist. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we have three segments addressing the tensions surrounding police shootings of black men and police who were ambushed and killed. Our first guest knows how dangerous the job of policing is because he was shot on the job. Tom Gibbons was hit by three bullets that nearly killed him. That was back in 1970 when he was a 25-year-old Philadelphia police officer working on highway patrol. Like today, it was a tense time. Six other officers were shot on the same weekend. One died. It was a time when the Philadelphia police were clashing with anti-war protesters and African-American activist groups. The day after Gibbons was shot, police raided three Black Panther offices in the city. Gibbons had to retire from the police as a result of his injuries. He became a reporter and covered the police for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He knew the territory from his own experiences and from his father, who served as Philadelphia's police commissioner from 1952 to 1960 and became known for instituting reforms to clean up the department. After five police officers were shot to death by a sniper in Dallas this month, Gibbons wrote a front-page story for the Inquirer about his own experience being shot. Tom Gibbons, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start by talking about what happened to you in 1970. You stopped a car and asked the driver for his license and registration. Why did you stop the car?
It was a brand new Eldorado. The trunk lock had been punched out. And that was always a prime indicator that something was amiss. And we decided to get a closer look. We were in an unmarked car, and I just gave the siren a little shot. They were surprised, and we just said, pull over. And they seemed very relaxed, and we both, my partner and I, got out of the unmarked car. We walked up. The driver had his window down. I asked for his driver's license and registration. And meanwhile, my partner had begun a little give and take with the passenger, very friendly. And I took my eyes off the driver just to look into the back seat when suddenly my partner yelled over the roof of the car, look out, Tom, he's got a, and I never heard the word. All I heard was a gunshot. And Terry, when you're that close to gunfire, it's loud. And he was reeling backward. Blood was streaming out of the side of his head. And John's warning to me.
This is your partner.
John Nolan. May have saved my life because I instinctively turned sideways to make myself a smaller target. And I looked at my guy, the driver, and he had a gun pointing right at me. And he had a grin on his face, a big grin, like he knew he was ahead of me. I started to draw my gun, and before I could bring my gun all the way up, he shot me. Now, the bullet did not hit my chest. It struck me in my right arm as I turned. The slug broke my right arm and severed my ulnar nerve. That's like your crazy bone.
Yeah.
Right by the elbow. My gun hand is dangling. Because I was so close to the driver, a mere several inches apart from the muzzle of his weapon, the force of the impact knocked me to the ground. And I turned around and I looked up at him, and he was leaning out of the car window. And now he starts to shoot as I'm on the ground. I get shot in the wrist, a real deep graze. I thought, this guy's trying to kill me. And I never looked back at him again. I just crawled as fast as I could across 59th Street, and there was a truck. And I thought, if I can just get under this truck, I'll have some cover. And just before I make it, I get hit a third time. This one right by my spine. Enters, ricochets off my pelvis, and it's a shame it didn't keep right on going, but it came up then through the torso and lodges in the skin just outside the right lung as a small bulge. It never left my body, that one slug. At that moment, I'm now under the truck, just about into the gutter, and I'm laying on my back, and I'm trying to figure what just happened.
Did you or your partner call the police for backup?
No. At this point, in those days, we stopped so many cars, and there wasn't a procedure in place. Nowadays, when officers pull a car over, they give their location. They let headquarters know, in effect. And in addition, in those days, we didn't wear protective vests. But as I laid in the gutter, and it's funny, highway patrol cops are very aware of their uniforms. Every night at roll call, we had a strict procedure. You were inspected. Your shirts had to be the creases razor sharp. Your boots had to be spit shined. And that was one of the crazy things that went through my mind. Boy, I wrecked this uniform. But then I worried, it got silent. And I didn't know where my partner was. And I didn't know where the bad guys were because nothing was happening after this vicious barrage of gunfire.
So you survived. Police, I don't know how they got there, but police came, took you to a nearby hospital.
Well, and I can explain how that went down. Nolan was knocked unconscious by the shot. Came to just as these two guys were jumping out of the stolen car on his side of the vehicle, on the passenger side. He's lying on the sidewalk. He opens fire on them, forces the driver back into the car. The passenger is running. He nicks him in the heel. That puts down a blood trail that eventually leads to his capture. A footnote to all of this, John and I were dear friends. He was the best shot, or just about the best shot, in our police academy class. We went through the academy together, and that paid off because he's shot in the head, had been knocked unconscious, opens fire, and nicks this guy that put the blood trail down that led to him being caught hiding in a house a couple blocks away.
So as somebody who was shot 3 times on the job and narrowly survived, what goes through your mind when you read about police who are shot now, like in Dallas, in Baton Rouge?
It hurts. And I'll tell you why it hurts. I come from a police family. And once a month, my father, on Saturday night, would ride the city with his aide in plain clothes in an unmarked car. And when they left the house every Saturday when this happened, my mother would be there. It was a routine. And I would hug my dad and we would say, "Be careful. Be careful, Dad." So, I mean, he was the boss, but he was going out there too. And I worried, and I would go to bed on Saturday night and I would hear him come home on Sunday morning, 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I would hear the door open, and I really felt at ease.
So you know what it's like to worry about an officer.
I know.
You really feel for the officers and for the families of officers who are shot or attacked.
Yes, officers who die, officers who are wounded. I was newly engaged when I was wounded. My wife-to-be went through a lot.
You had to retire from the police after you were shot because...
Yes. I retired in the summer of 72, and I didn't know what I was going to do. My parents had given me a good education, and I felt I would fall into something decent. And I had, out of high school in the early 60s, I had worked at the Evening Bulletin as a copy boy. And that was the fast track to becoming a street reporter in those days. But it didn't pay a whole lot. And the police department paid like 4 times as much. So I jumped over. My father was furious. We didn't speak for a year when I left the Bulletin and became a police officer. And it got even worse when I asked to be transferred into the highway patrol. He knew the dangers.
Your father was a police commissioner who served in Philadelphia as commissioner from 1952 to 1960?
Correct.
And he was appointed by the first Democratic mayor in many years. And the mayor, Joe Clark, and the mayor wanted your father, Thomas Gibbons Sr., to basically be a reform police commissioner.
Correct.
What were some of the reforms your father was responsible for?
Well, he carried out that mandate. First of all, police corruption. There had been several grand jury investigations. The federal Kefauver Commission, Senator Kefauver, looked into police corruption in Philadelphia. So corruption had to be cleaned up. And my father started right away by firing officers that he thought were performing unsatisfactorily. The commissioner could do that in those days. There also was a corruption. You would, instead of taking an exam, and you may have taken an exam, but you paid off your committee man to get into the police department. And my father ended that, I believe.
You mean kind of like bribed?
the committee man arranged.
Yeah.
You paid him.
Mm-hmm.
He arranged for you to become a cop. That was in the Republican administration, which had ruled for 67 and a half years. So you have anything around that long, you're going to have a lot of corruption. So to combat that, my father forced a lot of the senior commanders out. And as a result, he wasn't liked by the rank and file, and he didn't care. He wasn't liked by the FOP. And he did the multiplication one time, and he figured he fired 200 cops a year for 9 years.
When you decided to become a police officer, your father wasn't happy about that.
He wasn't happy about that.
Why not? What was his problem with you?
He mainly thought, and as a kid, as a young cop, I couldn't understand it. Now, when I look back, I thought, geez. He thought that I would be set up, that somehow, and he had a ton of enemies in the police department, he thought that somehow I would be set up and trapped and fired and maybe arrested.
By police who didn't like your father because of the reforms he instituted?
And that was his, I think that was his main concern. He also was worried that I could get hurt.
What kind of lasting impact do you think being shot has had on you?
In the beginning, as a young reporter, it didn't bother me one bit. It greatly affected my partner, John Nolan. He had a lot of trouble with it.
Psychological trouble.
But he...
Maybe drinking, too.
Drinking, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he, to his credit, he got over that. In fact, he even started a counseling operation in New Jersey. And what better guy to counsel officers involved in shootings than somebody who had been in a shooting? Now, every department has that kind of an operation. John was out there on his own. I give him a lot of credit with what he did.
So the person who shot you,
yes,
after robbing a bank and driving in a stolen Cadillac,
right,
was found guilty. He was prosecuted. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to how many years?
A maximum of 25 years.
So it would mean he's out now.
He's out. I don't know where he is. I never...
Do you ever think about that?
I thought about it one time when an editor approached me and he said, Tom, you know, this would make a great story, sort of like, you know, when Pope John Paul II forgave his assailant. If you track down your assailant and interviewed him, and I declined. I politely declined.
Tom Gibbons, thank you so much for talking about this. It's probably not your favorite subject to talk about?
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Tom Gibbons is a former Philadelphia police officer and a former reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he covered the police. After we take a short break, our contributor Matt Johnson considers the national conversation about officer-involved and officer-targeted killings from his perspective as a novelist and the father of black children. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. As we continue our show about this tense era of officer-involved and officer-targeted killings, we're going to hear from our contributor Matt Johnson, a fiction writer living in Houston, Texas. He's been thinking about what the craft of storytelling can offer us as we try to make sense of our times.
I write novels for a living, and novels are about how characters deal with their problems, those issues that make them who they are. Stories are about people facing their intrinsic conflicts and their efforts to overcome them. Sometimes they do, and sometimes, in tragedies, they don't. They succumb, resulting in ruin. Part of the heartbreak of watching The Nightmare Up the Highway for me in Dallas was seeing, like a story's dramatic conclusion, several of America's greatest inherent conflicts coming together in one moment. Fatally disastrous policing, our unresolved racial legacy dating back to the original sin of slavery and the century of socioeconomic disenfranchisement that followed it, our love of guns, and our reoccurring shame of the mass murders made possible by them. I watched That Night in Dallas like everyone else, through the lens of my own backstory. When I saw Philando Castile in Minnesota lying shot in his car, I thought of the time I was pulled over for speeding while stopped at a traffic light in East Houston. Or when I was pulled over for making a right on red in Giuliani's, New York. And me and the cop both knew I did so on green, and it was just an excuse to run my info through the system because he didn't like the way I looked. Of what might have happened in those moments if I wasn't privileged enough to pop into my most professorial voice, flash a faculty ID, and access all the adjacent off-white privilege my mixed heritage could provide. I watched Dallas as officers in a police force commended for their de-escalation efforts were murdered in the streets, and thought about teaching at my public university in Texas, where students this fall will now be able to legally walk through campus strapped with AR-15s on the way to pick up their grades. And I know others watched the events in Dallas and watched the unraveling in Baton Rouge with their own personalized scenes in their head, their own backstories, their own choice of media's catered facts, their own inherited prejudices, and came to completely different truths about what's going on in the world right now. When I was growing up, my mother taught me two central things about dealing with the cops while black, the same ones many black parents taught, that if you just stay out of trouble and docilely comply with whatever the cops want, you'll be okay. And that if the rest of the world saw what was really happening in deadly interactions between black people and the police, they'd see the problem. At this moment, those ideas seem like wishful self-delusions. I don't know what to tell my kids. A short while before his life was stolen, slain Baton Rouge police officer Montrell Jackson posted a Facebook message, eerily prescient of the national moment that would soon claim his life. He wrote, "In uniform, I get nasty, hateful looks, and out of uniform, some consider me a threat." His ultimate conclusion? "These are trying times. Please don't let hate infect your heart." Showed the type of insight that made him exactly the type of officer we need out there. And now he's lost to us. Right now, in the streets, online, and on TV, we as Americans are fighting over control of the national narrative. If it's the protesters' fault, or the cops, or a larger criminal justice system that's failing everyone. I understand why those who feel they aren't directly affected by this issue would be tempted to react to the complexity of what's going on by scapegoating or dismissing recent events as isolated incidents. We all have full, demanding lives. No one wants to add to the burden of dramatically changing how our society is functioning to their daily duties. But I don't have that privilege. What I have is Black children. Every time a Black person ends up dead after a police interaction, I read the details. I study them. I look for something they did, something they didn't do, something that I can tell my kids to avoid so that if they're ever pulled aside for a minor infraction by the wrong cop, they can come out alive. And for every single piece of advice I can give them, there is a hashtag name of someone who did the exact same thing and died. I'm petrified for my children. I'm petrified for my friends' children. I'm worried about the good cops out there whose jobs are getting more dangerous because of the injustices perpetrated by others. I'm scared for our country, that if we don't resolve our intrinsic conflicts, our inherent national flaws, that our story will end in ruin.
Matt Johnson is the author of the novels Loving Day and Pym. He teaches at the University of Houston Creative Writing Program. After we take a short break, Eric Adams is going to tell us about his dual perspective as a Black man who protested the police and also served as an NYPD officer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, providing tools to help people showcase their passions with a customizable landing page, website, or online store. Learn more at squarespace.com/NPR. And from the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a Black man and former police officer, my guest Eric Adams has a dual perspective on racism and the police. In a recent New York Times op-ed, he wrote that there were days when he marched shoulder to shoulder with outraged New Yorkers chanting, "No justice, no peace," after police shot and killed or brutally beat a Black man. There were evenings when he was policing the same protests, trying to keep the peace. And people would direct their anger at him, not realizing he'd stood with them just hours earlier. He says as a police officer, he tried to uphold the law while raising his voice to reform policing and make it better. In 1995, he co-founded the reform group, 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. After serving 22 years, he retired as a police captain. He was elected to the New York State Senate in 2006, Since 2013, he's served as the Brooklyn Borough President. Eric Adams, welcome to Fresh Air. In your recent op-ed, you wrote about the feeling you had when you were in uniform, that some people saw you, a police officer, and they saw the uniform, but they didn't see the man wearing it. What do you think they saw when they looked at you and just saw the uniform, the cop?
I think that we're in a country of symbols. And that's that symbol and that reflection changes depending on what relationship you had with a law enforcement officer. If you were a victim of a crime and a law enforcement officer was there to provide the nurture and the care or to save the life of you or your family, that symbol is different. But if every encounter you had with a police officer was a negative symbol, then when you see that uniform, that shield, that gun, it becomes a symbol of repressive behavior. And I think that's what people saw.
So what did that do to you as a police officer when you felt that somebody looking at you saw you as a symbol of oppression?
If I was not very much a part of raising my voice for reform and change, it would have made me bitter, like many black officers are. But because I spent so much time raising my voice to reform the police department, I understood that when people looked at the uniform, they did not see my face, they saw the uniform. And I did not take it personal. I understood that the uniform came off, and I was among those people who were still yelling, "No justice, no peace. It's time for change." And so it was easy for me to adopt that understanding. But that is not what the overwhelming number of officers of color, many of them have bought into the police culture, and they play very little, if not any role at all, of moving towards reform.
When you use the expression police culture, what are some of the things you have in mind?
Or how we police in America, and that is at the heart of the problem. We police in America in communities of color and economically challenging community. We police based on the behavior of the numerical minority that is committing crime. That small percentage of people who commit crimes in a community becomes the methods that's used for the entire community. And that's part of the culture of policing, the culture of using violence extremely quickly, teaching people a lesson, the Bull Connor mindset of, "Are you eyeballing me, boy?" The thought that you cannot talk back or you cannot question the behavior, the theory of, "I would rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6, meaning you would rather have a jury decide your decision than being carried in a coffin, taking precaution for yourself. If you are in an encounter with a black person that's carrying a firearm, not trying to find out first if he's a law enforcement person with the right to carry a firearm or if he's a licensed person. So it's the culture of believing black equals crime. And that is how police is carried out throughout this entire country. And that's the culture that we're fighting against to reverse.
When you were a police officer and you would get a hostile reaction from someone because you are a cop and because you are seen as a symbol of oppression, how would that affect how you interacted with that person? Because you don't see yourself as that symbol of oppression. You know that you have always been a pro-reform cop, and that's probably one of the reasons why you joined the force in the first place. But again, the other person doesn't know that. So what do you do to prevent that interaction from getting more contentious than it really needs to be?
By clearly understanding where the person is coming from. And not, again, it's so important not to personalize the attack that you're receiving from people. I've had individuals call me everything from Uncle Tom to sellout to, you know, Negro to oppressor. And then when you show the right demeanor and show that you are not going to be absorbed by those name calling and understand that they're not calling Eric Adams' name. They're calling what the uniform represent. So your approach is different. Sometimes just making a sentence of support really disarm people. And oftentimes I would simply say, "I thank you for standing up for me when I'm not wearing this uniform."
So you're talking about patrolling police protests.
Exactly.
I wasn't even thinking about that, but that's a really interesting point that you've had to patrol protests against police when your sympathies were probably at least partially with those demonstrators.
Without a doubt, more times than not, if it was demonstration against Abner Louima, Diallo, so many others throughout the time, being at those protests and seeing the anger from people and just letting them know, you would be surprised how a simple comment of, you know, thank you for fighting for me when I'm not in this uniform, how much it changes the mindset of the person who believe that you don't know why they are there. Because keep in mind, there were many fights that black police and Hispanic police had to fight within the police department to get their rights to exist within the police department. So the struggle didn't stop merely because we put on a blue uniform. Our fight continued.
Did you have to fight for your own equal rights within the department when you joined?
All the time. I was denied access to the police department until my list that I was on, a list runs for 4 years. They kept postponing my appointment until finally the Guardians Association, which was the fraternal organization of black police, sued the police department because they saw a pattern of black and Hispanic officers or recruits or candidates being pushed to the back of the list and then dying on the list. And finally a judge sued and forced them to hire our list. And throughout my tenure in the police department, we were, you know, targeted and had to fight for basic rights, even promotions. The promotional list I was on, Commissioner Kelly at the time, attempted to terminate the list 2 names before my name until there was an uproar by the overwhelming number of white officers who were behind my name. And then he had to reinstate it. And then walking out the door, there was an attempt to fire me. Until in their own departmental trial, the judge ruled out of the 3 charges they brought against me, the judge ruled 2 in my favor and 1 in their favor, so I was able to retire with my pension intact. So the career never stopped fighting, and it was a continuous battle, which I was surprised that I finished 22 years. I thought I would be going in the first year because I was going in for a mission. And little did I know that 22 years later, I was going to leave as a captain and walk out the door and not being thrown out the door.
Clearly, you feel comfortable calling out individual cops who have either panicked or done the wrong thing and hurt or killed somebody as a result. And you were critical of certain policing tactics, openly critical of them, while you were a police officer. My impression is, and I know a lot of people believe this, that there's this attitude of you don't break ranks when you're a police officer. You just stand behind what an officer has done. You support them, or at least you don't criticize them in public. And I'd like to hear if you think that that's still the case and what you think of that kind of general attitude of, you know, we stand behind other cops, we don't break rank.
Police have 2 rights that even a president does not have, the right to take liberty and to take life. Those are dear to America. And we must ensure that the highest level of scrutiny and standard goes to anyone who's given that right. And that is why I critiqued and looked at how we were policing to say, if you're going to wear this uniform and this badge, you must be of the highest quality. And where I saw that we were not moving in the direction where we ought to move, I was extremely vociferous about it while I wore the uniform because I was proud of it.
My guest is Eric Adams. He was a New York City cop for 22 years and is now the Brooklyn Borough President. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where treatment options include targeted therapies guided by genomic testing and immunotherapies that use the body's immune system to help fight the cancer. More at cancercenter.com. And from Subaru, automotive partner of the National Park Service Centennial. Subaru encourages people to explore America's treasures and discover a national park adventure at findyourpark.com. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Adams. We're talking about his dual perspective as a black man who protested police and also served as an NYPD officer for 22 years. He's now the Brooklyn Borough President. In 1995, when you were on the NYPD, you co-founded a group called 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. What was that group?
Amazing group of 100 people, men and women, who shared the same philosophy that I did, that we must provide public safety for the communities that we lived in, and we must ensure that the police department reaches the standard that they treated everyone in the symbol that justice is blind and we were fair within our police agencies.
One of the things that this group did was organize workshops for people on how to handle encounters with police. What to do if you're stopped in a car? What to do if a policeman knocks on the door and asks to enter and maybe search? Why did you think it was so important to have these sessions informing people of how to handle it?
Because you have to live life in the real and then take it to the ideal. And far too many people felt as though a black child, a black family, a black man should not have to be taught how to interact with the police because this is America and no one should have to be taught that.
Like everybody knows.
Right. And that's where people were wrong. Yes, you should not have to be taught that. But the reality is that people were losing their lives over not knowing what to do. And not only were they losing their lives over a physical encounter, as in death, many people's lives were destroyed because they were being arrested for petty offenses. And that caused people to lose their livelihood, spend time in jail. And so we wanted to give people some very simple instructions on how to survive an encounter with a police officer.
Give us an example. Give us an example of something that you found a lot of people didn't understand about how to deal with a police encounter.
Well, remember, police officers go through months of training. Here in New York City is 6 months. And they learn laws and rules. The public receive their understanding of an interaction from looking at CSI Miami or some police program. And so we had to bridge that gap. I believe that interaction, basic interaction with policing should be taught in schools so that young people would know that. But one of the biggest mistakes that people would have is when a police officer approached their car and asked for their driver's license, and they would say, "Why are you stopping me? What was the reason you stopped?" Keep in mind, that police officer don't know who you are. And his first order of determining if he's dealing with a dangerous situation is to de-escalate the situation and get the identification from the person. If there's pushback, then all of a sudden it heightens his concern and his tension. He needs to control that situation to the best that he can so he can carry out his action. And so we taught people, give the officer your driver's license and information, then start having a conversation of, "Officer, why was I stopped?" De-escalate the situation. Turn on the interior lights of your car. Let them see your hands. Do the things that are right. And that's why the shooting where the gentleman stated, "I have a gun in the car," is such a terrible shooting, because he communicated with the officer, and he did it in a textbook fashion, and he still was shot. That should never happen.
Did you find that at some of these workshops that some of the people, particularly young men, might have resisted the advice you were giving because it went against their idea of what they needed to do to be respected and to stand up for themselves as men?
Yes, without a doubt. And so what we would do role reversals. We would allow them to be the cop, and we would be the passenger in the car. We would be the person who's behind the door that's being served a warrant. We would be the person that stopped on the street. Because when they were able to carry out the function of the police officer and see what it is to throw their hands around, to walk past someone, when they saw the frustration and how difficult it is, and one scenario we will have them stop someone walking down the street and they didn't control the scenario and the person will pull out a gun and shoot them. It gave them a true perspective of it is not a cut and dry situation. And they understood more after completing those forums of how the most important thing you can do as a civilian is to de-escalate the encounter, bring a level of comfort so everyone walks away not being arrested, not being harmed, not being killed.
I believe you retired from the police force before cell phones and body cams and dashboard cams play the kind of role that they play now, where you see them on cable news all the time and we're watching over and over, police who have shot people. So what's your impression as a former police officer and now borough president in New York City, Brooklyn Borough president, about the role those cameras are playing and whether they're helping or hurting police in doing their job?
Who would have thought that Steve Jobs would have such an impact on policing in America?
That's an interesting point. I never quite thought of it that way.
For many years, people of color were talking about being shot, being brutalized, being arrested, and it was ignored because I always borrow from Jack Nicholson's comment in A Few Good Men when he said that you really don't want to know the truth. The reality is that much of America...
And if I can quote precisely, you can't handle the truth.
Exactly.
Yes.
And a lot of America, for the most part, wanted to drive their car in their manicured lawns and just wanted to know that you dealt with the crime whichever way you wanted or had to. But when those photos and images came into their living room, the reality is that when people had to see it, when they had to see someone shot in the back, when they had to see someone choked out, when they had to see someone beaten, it forced them to say, wait a minute, something is wrong here. And so body cameras are so important. And it is amazing that the same police agencies and organizations that push against body cameras would go at a crime scene and look for any video that they have to solve the crime, to tell the true picture and the true story. And then the information shows overwhelmingly. One chief of police study showed that in over 80% of the time when cameras are involved, it exonerated the cops who did the right thing. So the tool is a good tool, but law enforcement culture is afraid of change. And it's afraid of anything that will scrutinize their action and behavior. The arrogance of don't question us because we protect you is a thing of the past. Steve Jobs made everyone now a director of a movie that could determine what the end of the script would be.
My guest is Eric Adams. He was a New York City cop for 22 years and is now the Brooklyn Borough president. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Adams. We're talking about his dual perspective as a black man who protested police and also served as an NYPD officer for 22 years. He's now the Brooklyn Borough President. My understanding is that one of the reasons why you became a police officer is because when you were 15, you were beaten by police. You were arrested. You'd done something wrong. You'd broken into a place, and I don't know the story behind it. But, I mean, you broke the law. You did something wrong. That didn't mean you should have been beaten. You were beaten to the point where you were pissing blood for about a week. So what did that do to you in terms of hating the police or wanting to become one?
My brother and I were both arrested together, and we were both abused together. And the police officers who arrested us did not hit us all over our body. They just kicked us in our groin repeatedly. And as you indicated, it caused the urination of blood for, you know, almost 7 days. And my brother left there hating cops, said he wanted nothing to do with cops. I left there with the belief that it was behind me. It was a bad encounter. But as life went on, I realized that every time I saw a police vehicle, every time I watched a police show, every time I heard a siren, I relived that. And it never goes away. And so I understood that there was a demon inside me, and the only way I can get it out is for me to go in. And going in meant becoming a police officer. And so that is why I went in with such an aggressive mindset of reform, because I thought that if I spent a year and a half, if I survived that long of being extremely vocal, that it would start the process. And so I was angry. I was hurtful, but it became therapeutic for me that I was standing up for what I thought was right. And it allowed that demon to come out. And I feel I became a whole person because of that.
So what was it like the first time you put on a police uniform and you looked at yourself in the mirror in that uniform that you had previously come to hate?
It was life-changing. Because you're right. You put on that uniform and you look in the mirror and you realize that when you put that uniform on, you are also putting on the uniform of pain, the uniform of hate, the uniform of disgust. You're putting on the uniform that represented exploitation of people. You're putting on a uniform that represented some of the partnership between the Klan and the hanging of black men. You're putting on a uniform of those who participated in some of the most horrific historical actions against the people that you were a part of. And then you're putting on a uniform that personally attempted to break your manhood. And you look there, you look at it, and you ask yourself, is this something you really want to do? And it took a while before I realized that, yes, you have to do this. This is the right thing to do. If I would not have done that, if I would not have gone through the fear of wearing that uniform, I would still be walking around a broken person.
So when you did put on the uniform and become an officer, what did your brother think?
He felt that I betrayed what we stood for, like many young black men. He felt that it was the wrong thing to do. He harbored a lot of hate. And not only my brother, but the young men I grew up with, everyone felt that you become a sellout. And that was part of what we wanted to change. We wanted to change the mindset that when you protect and serve your community, you're not selling out. You're allowing other young people to get out of the way of violence, the way of police abuse. And over time, when people saw how vociferous we were, it was a complete change of mindset they understood that, hey, you can become a cop and not have to give up your soul in the process.
Eric Adams, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Eric Adams served on the New York Police Department for 22 years. He's now the Brooklyn Borough President. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interview with the showrunner of HBO's comedy series Veep, David Mandel, and comic Mike Birbiglia, who directed the new film Don't Think Twice, check out our podcast. You'll find those and other interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T. And from ADT Security, helping to protect families and homes for over 140 years. Learn more at ADT.com.